So, early Sunday morning, live on the pod with Dave Murray. Have I said it right?
You have. Well done.
Jackpot. Live from Japan, which is exciting, out there skiing. How you doing, mate? You well?
Okay, I'm freezing in Hokkaido, about as close to Vladivostok as I am from Tokyo. But I had a good day skiing, apart from getting really cold.
Nice. And you, look, we met, where was it? Was it Castleford? Is that where the snow...
Yeah, UK Snow Sports Coaching Conference. First time we've ever met. And the only time.
Yeah, the only time. And as I can't see your face, it's quite... It's anyway, at the home of skiing in England, Castleford. I loved your stuff. I loved listening to your talk. I've taken away and tried old way, new way, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit later. So, do you want to kind of try and explain to people, well, how did you end up in Japan today? What's the journey that's led you there?
Oh, that's a long journey. I wanted to be an architect and a town planner, ended up at Loughborough doing sports science instead. Got a love of rugby, actually, by, this'll tell you my age, Jim Greenwood finishing his book on total rugby.
Yeah, I've got a book.
And that's why I love watching Japan play. It reminds me of that. And I watched Loughborough students when Clive Woodward was about to get into the England team as a player. So that's how long ago. But I went to rugby school, but I always had my Mike Catt Jonah Lomu moment, because you know how big I am.
Yeah, I'd imagine you were a scrum half, David. That would be my guess.
Well, would you believe I started off as hooker?
Wow.
I went to scrum half, and I ended up on the wing, because basically I was fast. I was good in attack, but in defence I was useless. But I loved watching it at Loughborough, and I liked watching rugby more than I liked football, even though I was a much better footballer. But really, I was an athlete. So that's how I ended up at Loughborough as an athlete. I said I'd never, ever be a PE teacher because I wouldn't be able to do the job. So I went to Carnegie, became a PE teacher. Then I moved into university. And loved doing teacher education. Absolutely adored that job. Worst job for pay I ever had. Best job for satisfaction. And I specialised in athletics and football, having previously taught PE, maths and physics. But I ended up doing more biomechanics because very few people were any good at teaching biomechanics. You'll find a much better biomechanician or researcher than me. But what I was interested in was bringing it alive to the students, making it relevant. And so I ended up with a career in lecturing, but always liked the teacher training. So I went back into schools to get recent, relevant, substantial experience, as Maggie Thatcher put it. And as a consequence, I finally got to go skiing for the first time. And I was so keen, I introduced snowboarding on the curriculum to the school. First school ever to have snowboarding on its curriculum. Took the children out for an extracurricular activity, snowboarding and skiing. And the local dry slope saw how keen I was. They saw one day that I'd set up a video camera at the bottom of the slope and was just videoing my own runs and analysing my own runs. So within 12 months of putting a pair of skis on my feet, they said, "Would you want to train as an instructor?"
Wow.
So that was the journey. Took me a long time to do snow instruction. But by that time, I'd done a lot of coach education for British Athletics for about 15 years. That was a passion for me. Went back into universities. And interestingly, the teacher training all moved really into schools, sensibly. But it took away that part of the job that I really liked. So I ended up doing a lot of curriculum design. And these were sports related degrees, which had a practical component, a lot of sports medicine, a lot of coaching. And that was what I got interested in. I ended up becoming head of department in sports science departments because of the curriculum design, quality assurance side, which I really like. But I ended up going from having a tracksuit on all day to having a suit on all day. Decided I wanted a bit of a change, so I ended up in America lecturing. And out there, they thought it strange that somebody was coaching and had multiple coaching awards and interests. And I ended up coaching collegiate women's basketball and a little bit of American football, where I worked on the speed of the players. And in the basketball, I was mainly working on the warm-up, the injury prevention, and particularly ACL injury prevention stuff. My passion was always linking the theory to the practice and making that relevant. So I did that. I came back. When I came back, I nearly stayed in America. I got a green card, but I came back and then got the wanderlust again. Went out to India for a three-month project before the Commonwealth Games and worked with a consortium of schools to develop a new PE curriculum and coach education. From that led to going to Singapore as the track and field coach at the National Sports School. And by a chance encounter with former, sadly, the late Clive Rushton, who was captain of the Olympic swim team in 1972, he was the coach out there and introduced me to Joseph Schooling's father to do starts for Joseph. And Joseph was the up-and-coming Singaporean who was the only... So swimming, and we worked on his starts, and he went away and he ended up winning gold at the Olympics, beating Phelps. He was first out the blocks, first at the start, so that was nice to see. But all I gave him was a program to develop his starts. I only had one day with him before I left Singapore. But that was quite nice. And it's all about transferring the knowledge of how the body moves to real performance. And so I've done a variety of things. But when I came back, I worked for UCFB, the football place. I headed up their coaching sciences area. I ended up very much in a suit, put on about a stone of weight, and said, it's time I went back to the consultancy, the freelance, and I bought a ski apartment. And so I worked more on the skiing side of things. When I go back from here, I go to my apartment and I'll be coaching a little 10-year-old Welsh champion.
Right, wow. I can't imagine you in a suit, for starters.
Well, when I left UCFB, I went to my sister's birthday party. I tried the three suits on and none of them fitted me. I couldn't wear the suit. So it kick-started my return to fitness campaign.
Yeah, I just can't imagine you in a suit just because of your energy and, you know, the outdoors lifestyle and that type of stuff. It would be tough wear for me for a suit. I mean, it would definitely be a tough wear for you.
Sure. Well, that's what happened, but the salary was very enticing at the time. So I managed it for a while. And as I say, the big thing for me was turning around sports programs, which weren't doing terribly well. My beef with them was a lot of universities jumped on the bandwagon of sports science because they had science, but it wasn't popular. Sports science was popular, but basically it was science without any sport in it. There's a lot of those about.
Wow. Yeah. So a couple of things that I'm thinking about. One is, why so much satisfaction from coach education?
Well, I tell you what, when I started doing teacher education, a lot of it was around athletics, which is a Cinderella subject in schools. And I loved bringing it alive and then going out to watch the students on teaching practice and seeing them do things relevant that the children started to enjoy and learn something from. So we would do things like try to break the world record for the mile or a 4-minute mile in a team of five.
Oh, right. I love it. I love it already.
So And they'd go flat out in this relay, get absolutely exhausted and not be performing, and then think, wow, these guys must be really fast. Instead of them running a 1500 meters, we did that. And then we'd go for sprinting, we'd do, right, world record for the 100 meters, 9.58 seconds. How far can you run in 9.58 seconds? Yeah. So whistle goes, you run, your partner puts a marker down how far you went, then you look at how far the 100 meters is. Because one of the things that really appealed to me was, what's the essence of the sport? So the essence of sprinting is to run fast. If you put a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old in 100 meters, it's a speed endurance event. It's not, it's not a sprint. So I did that, and I learned that a little bit by watching indoor sports hall athletics, and thought, this is how to bring it alive. And when I see the kids' faces and the students' faces, that they're students who know nothing about athletics when they walk into college. They don't really like it. They know they're going on teaching practice in the summer, and they think, oh my God, how am I going to deal with javelins and kids that are bored? And so I got a real buzz out of changing. I like improving things and taking something that's pretty redundant and not very good and making it into something worthwhile.
And
so I ended up finding I was a better coach educator, in a sense, than a coach, because I had a passion for it.
Yeah, we were debating with the pod, actually, having some kind of, you know, so say you get a rock star, let's say it's a rugby player, let's say it's, I don't know, let's say it's Faf de Klerk to do something.
And yeah.
And press-ups, and Faf can do 100 press-ups, then actually, you know, in next time period, yeah, we were thinking about that. How do you then bring that to life? So people who are guests can do it. I'm not going to make you do press-ups now, David. For example, love the way of actually relating it to. So how did you do it with javelin? So here's my javelin. You have Jan Zaleski finishing a point. You have to throw and hit the finishing point. We work your way back towards the start line. So at least you're towards the end rather than.
With things like long jump world record, we say, how many long jumps will it take you to make it to there?
Yeah.
How many standing long jumps? Another thing that I like to do, you know, if you take something like high jump, if you're tall, you tend to have an advantage. So what we would do is adjust it for whether you were able to clear your head height. So you take away the height of the person from the height they actually jumped. And then the winner is the one with the best differential.
Nice.
But we also go, I'd walk across to the football pitch, walk them under the crossbar and say, do you realize the world record holder could jump over that? And you see a 10-year-old look up at it and it looks like it's the moon.
Yeah,
but it's interesting because, you know, my PE at school wasn't like that. But I was the motivated one. I was very coachable. I wanted to please. And I was fairly talented. And so I survived in a system that wasn't very good. So when I ended up going into PE teaching thinking I'd be useless at it, I was looking for ways to engage the kids. And my way to engage them was content. It had to be good content. It had to be relevant. And when I started succeeding, there's nothing boosts you like success.
Yeah.
And I wanted to pass that on to students. And spread that around. And so that really was it. And to be honest, my coaching improved because of my teaching practice supervision. Because I've seen so many sessions, so many coaching sessions, a lot of them not very good, and by people who are learning their trade. But it made me stand back, and I had good training at Chichester College. And there it was about asking the question. You start off by saying, what went well? Because the first thing that the student wants to do is defend and say, oh, that was crap, and tell you all that was wrong with it. So it's like, what went well? What did you do? What was the best thing you did? And then, okay, what didn't go so well? And why was that? Instead of telling them what was wrong with it, draw it out of them. And previously, I'd been a fairly autocratic coach. and my coaching of football was terrible. I've done some awful sessions. You know, I can remember the thing that made me learn most was this phrase that still irritates me. Sir, when can we have a game? Sir, when are we going to play the game? And I was at that point doing traditional drills followed by game, and then thinking, why the hell is passing just as bad in the game as it was before? Why hasn't my drill worked? And I switched to small-sided games with a condition at the start to bring out something, to prove the need for the practice, go away and practice it, and then come back. So it was engaging them in that process. But I had more success when I was teacher training and trying to help students solve that problem that I'd wrestled with so many times. And the most successful thing I did, apart from using handball from a strategic point of view, was using a version of line ball. Don't know if you'd come across it. If you imagine Rugby X, but with a combination of rugby league and American football rules. So basically you have a small team indoors in the sports hall, team of six, and they've got five attempts to score in the end zone. Those five are like the five plays in rugby league. So they have or five downs. You restart the game with a chicken scratch and it's touch. They are allowed one forward pass in the game or forward kick, but not for position. It has to be for possession and trying to score. And then I just get them to have a huddle before every play and try and work out what they're going to do, while the defense also has a huddle and they work out what they're going to do. And all of a sudden, the quality of the play, the quality of the interaction, and I never got anybody say, when are we going to have a game, sir?
Yeah. John Fletcher plays that game.
So is he?
Yeah, he plays that game. He played it in the sports hall at Sheffield Hallam University the other day. And yeah. The kids were so engaged in it. And as you say, it becomes very interactive, you know, it becomes very tactical around, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to do that? We then had them put each team had superpowers. So you actually had a rule the other team didn't know. So for example, one team were actually there, if they did a try not involving the forward pass or the forward kick, they got five times as many points. So they were trying to deceive by putting people in the backfield, knowing that they were going to probably try and run it. So, and then you get the whole, well, how do we work with each other? It was a great game.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, this is where I give a shout out to you. When I always go to these conferences and learn something from someone. But you kicked off that conference and gamification, I thought, what the hell's that? You're talking to somebody who thinks of games as space invaders. You know, that was me. That's the only game I'd played. So it didn't make any sense to me at first. I listened to you and I thought I'd done some innovative stuff relating to kids, but this is just completely new to me. Yeah. And I was so fascinated by it.
Amy Price, shout out. So I'm sure you were doing bits of it, and I was definitely doing some bits, but then Amy Price puts it all together. Here's the principles. You go. And I now look at it and go, 20 years I haven't used this. How have I missed this? You played around with some of it?
So I since we talked about it, since I heard you talk about it, I've thought about it and I thought I need to find ways of doing this with, but most of the people I'm coaching, and it's on an individual basis, they're not really gamers. So I've not had the need to do it, if you see what I mean. Or big opportunity to bring it in, but if I was going back to my teacher ed stuff on invasion games, it would be, I'd be all over it like a rash. It's fantastic.
And how does, so I'm already excited thinking about the line ball in the sports hall and invasion games. You coach lots of individuals, so you coach skiing, which So a couple of things about the ski conference. One was, I walked in and I thought he was going to be a younger average age. However, I absolutely loved the playfulness of the people in the room. It blew my mind. They were so playful. And then I really was curious, and definitely some of the stuff you talk about was about how do you work in a sport where there's often just one person you're coaching, and it's much more, my sense is it's much more kind of autonomy supported than, well, certainly than the coaching experiences we had when we were younger. And but even then, the coaching experiences that go on now in invasion sports. So clearly the person who's skiing understands, you know, has some understanding of how they're feeling and what they're noticing. And I mean, so how, what's going on in skiing that's different that, that we could all learn from?
It's a hard one. One thing that I think is really different is when I'm, say, coaching in invasion games, I'm trying to create an environment. In skiing, you have to deal with the environment that's in front of you and try to manage that environment and do your best in that environment. You don't create a new one, if you see what I mean. The terrain, the snow conditions, the weather, the temperature. It's so you're coming at it perhaps from an opposite perspective some of the time. However, it is a adapting and a problem solving approach. What I think is not good in a lot of ski racing, and it's partly expectation driven, is if you're not in gates, you're not coaching. If you're not set up a gates course and everybody goes down that same gates course and runs it five or six times, if you go free skiing, as we call it, and work on skills in an open environment, that's not considered necessarily doing your job. It's a bit like you're not doing good speed work if you're not doing speed, agility, quickness, ladders. That would be the...
You're not doing good rugby coaching unless you're sitting cones out and you've got some bags.
Yeah, yeah. So we have the same kind of issues, I would say. And what you would find is a lot of the people coaching racing would not have been in that room. They'd be the young ex-racers who are delivering the kind of program that they had when they got to the Scottish national team or the England national team, but probably didn't go further, mainly for a funding reason, because it's a really expensive sport. That's one of the big problems with skiing. It's such an expensive sport. But I would wholeheartedly support the varied practice. That just because you're a slalom racer, it doesn't mean you shouldn't be working in the moguls. It doesn't mean you shouldn't be working off-piste and developing your basic fundamentals, posture, stance, balance, manipulation of the ski, but in a wide variety of environment and opportunity, and not become one rigid way of doing things.
I loved your, and I hope I've got it right, Alberto Tombo.
Sorry, say that again.
Your Alberto Tombo story. That you talking about him being on the really flat slopes.
I think that might have been somebody else. I don't remember saying that.
but it just tied in with that. So they spoke about Alberto Tombo training on really flat slopes,
yeah,
so that he could actually understand how he could generate speed on a, you know, on, yes, a 1 degree slope, as an example. So as, yeah, you're saying, you know, you go on the powder, you go on the moguls, you have to, you know, it's, yeah, you've got to start to understand balance and how you generate, yeah, speed and all those things.
Well, Dave Riding, who is our best current skier and our best hope, and he's in slalom, learnt his trade on the dry slopes and learnt how to generate speed. And he's brilliant on the flats. And so he's somebody who grew up on dry slopes and is in the top 10 in the world, which a few years ago people wouldn't have thought possible.
No, that's a true story. What and the other thing he talks about that I definitely wanted to delve into is, so, and it's something I'm now experiencing, you get to watch so many coaches that you just learn so much stuff. Where are you going? What coaches are you watching? Is it across sports? How intentionally are you watching and what are you looking at as a coach, educator, coach developer as well?
think being semi-retired, I don't do as much as I used to do. But I work alongside coaches, and I see a lot of coaches. When you're out on the slopes, you see a lot. So actually following somebody in skiing would be quite difficult. It's who you're coming across as you're going around the place. But I was out in Austria with some of the Basie trainers who are race coaching for what is the Eurotest. And I involved myself with them. They were happy for me to work on stuff which was about knee protection and back protection, and closely related with them, joined in the sessions. They were coaching me as well. And there's some really good coaches that were getting great praise from what are instructor trainees, if you like. So we do have them in Britain. I think one of the worst things that we sometimes fall foul of is assuming that the top nations like Austria, for example, or the US have better technical coaches, as opposed to, well, it's not all about technical. And we do have some great people who are good at putting the message across and developing fundamental skills. So I was there for me. I still wanted to do the old way, new way. I had a bad habit that I got. I've still got it, and I've been working on it here. And I got help with that from the coaches that were there.
Do you want to explain old way, new way?
Okay, so I came across this some years ago out of the Australian Institute of Sport, and it resonated with me because it was about if you try to shape your way out of a fault or a habit that you've got that holds you back, and it's normally a technical habit that you have, under pressure you tend to always fall back into that habit. So if you shape your way out of it, you'll have the tendency to fall back into the habit very easily when it's under pressure. But if you learn the new way as a different skill, different technique, then when you actually have the ability to start the technique from the new position, your motor program will lead you to automatically, eventually, go down a new path and not fall back into the old habit. So it will, under pressure, you keep the new way of doing things. But you have to be able to differentiate the two, and you have to spend quite a long time learning the skill from the start as a new skill, not trying to just modify your old skill.
Cool. So can I give you a couple of examples of how I've used it?
Yeah.
And by the way, I probably haven't had enough time. I'm often in and out. So with a player that, and you can tell me where I'm going wrong, with a player who has had his hands by his side and kept dropping the ball, my natural instinct would be put your hands up. And actually I decided, I felt brave enough, I felt it was, that the kid would be able to cope with it. I said, right, well, are you curious about why you dropped the ball? And then we talked about old way, new way, and I said, look, do you want to try 10 minutes of the old way? Are you cool with that? And about 2 minutes in, he was still dropping the ball and getting agitated, and we persevered. And then we went and did 10 minutes of new way, and then actually, do you want to have a go back at it just to feel it? How weird it feels almost. And then went back to new way. So, and I've had good feedback from that kid on the impact it's had. I've also tried it with coaches. So the coach who does a very long soliloquy, you know, there's 7-8 minutes of just talking. So instead of instinct is to reduce the time, I've actually set them the challenge of, are you keen for a challenge? However many huddles we've got left in the session, two of them need to be at least 7 minutes of just you talking and not asking questions. And we want to, we talk about the new way as well, and we scaffold it in and then go, right, let's talk about how it feels. It's like, it's ridiculous, Rusty. It's actually quite hard to do.
Yeah.
So just and it's clearly within a space where I feel comfortable that it's the right thing to do, and that it's a person that I know well. I'm definitely not going, I did debate going to the side of the pitches in Singapore recently and say, come on, parents, let's get properly on the pitch and shout at the kids. Come on, let's do it for 10 minutes. And then we can maybe do 10 minutes of behaving like rational human beings.
Yeah, I think one of the features of differentiating the two is that the person who's trying to change, or that you're trying to change, is able to articulate the difference between them.
Yeah.
And explain what they're doing. Once they can explain it, they can then try practicing it and then switching between the two at will, until they can quite easily go, if they start rambling on, they continue rambling on because it's autopilot. But if they've got a cue to do it another way, and they can click that one in, once they click it in, so maybe they just need a cue to set them up to go down a positive path rather than a don't do that. Yeah. Because once you say don't do that, you're concentrating on that thing you don't want to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been really interesting for me just to play around with it, quite frankly, and just see what the impact's been.
I noticed you immediately. You went away. You found the articles online, and I hadn't even given those references out. So I thought, he's obviously keen. He wants to use that one.
It just made me. It's a bit like when I found out about gamification. Yeah, I mean, the reality is that sometimes think, you know what, I'm starting to get a bit of, you know, I'm starting to get a bit of, you know, a groove here. I'm starting to get this coaching lark. And then something comes along and you go, oh God, really? Wow. And that's probably been, you know, in the last few months, certainly the Old Way, New Way and the Amy Price's video game design stuff has had big impact. When you said, I'm just going to pick up on something else you said. So when you were talking about skiing, you said it's not all technical. I think it's something we have in rugby. Often we are trying to solve. So tackling, as an example. So I see, you know, Sunday morning. It's Sunday morning here. We're about to go out and do some coaching. People will almost certainly attribute a missed tackle to a technical problem. When it often isn't. So, you know, there'll be some. It's definitely some transfer from skiing, where I can't remember you, so apologies. I did think someone said that the best skier is the one who can. It's just skiing is almost bravery, as is tackling.
Yes.
It's some biomechanics stuff around tackling as well that people are unaware of.
I think one of the
experiences of technical versus skill.
Well, one of the biggest things I think in skiing, and you can take a beginner, you can take a recreational skier, is fear of the slope, fear of falling, fear of the speed. They'll automatically go back. Doesn't matter how good you think you've taught them technically, they won't do it. So my phraseology usually is, I take somebody to a slope and I say, would you be happy to go straight down that slope? And just go straight, not even try and turn. If they say yes, I can do any kind of technical work on that slope I like. I can get them to try skiing on one ski because they're not inherently afraid of the slope. If they're inherently afraid of the slope right from the start, I'm on a hiding to nothing. So where you take people, which part of the mountain, what type of snow is so crucial to the success of what you're trying to do, and whether they have fun or not, and whether they gain confidence or not, and whether they improve or not. That's half the battle, is reading the terrain and what they're likely to do on that terrain.
Would you be happy to tackle that kid if he ran at full pace? In which case, yeah, I mean, it's probably a reasonable question to ask.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure enough people are asking that question.
Yes, yeah. As I say, that was my downfall. I could play sevens quite well, but don't expect me to defend because I'm useless.
I would not be happy to tackle John Lomas.
And they all seemed like Jonah Lomu to me when I was, you know, when I was 15, I was even smaller than you've seen me now.
Yeah, wow. And what else have you said? So what are the other kind of, how else have you tied in? So your biomechanics stuff, I was really interested in the the slides you showed up there. How have you translated that to your coaching practice in skiing and I guess in the invasion stuff as well?
I think it's, for me, it was always, I didn't want to explain science and physics to people. I wanted to look, I'm an observer of human movement, and somehow that's, there's a logic to it that I can see in my head about what feels and looks like good movement, what flows well, what has power, how the power is transmitted, triple extension, etc. That seems to come, or nowadays comes fairly naturally. So I look for good movement, and I tend to say good movement looks good. And if you see somebody with power, you know it instantly, they've got power. And when they haven't got power, and when they're not using their ankles, where they're not using their hips, where they're sitting back and can't be in good balance, they're just hanging on the boots or something like that. So I bring it in, but without talking specifically about biomechanics, if you like.
Cool. Give me some examples. Give me some stuff that people could maybe take across to their world.
Okay. Well, if we take running. So you if you most games involve running. So I'd want somebody to run hips high, good extension of the ankle, and a full triple extension when they're driving off that leg, whether they're changing direction or whether they're accelerating away. So these sorts of things that I would see. What I find is you get people talking about teaching people to run faster, and they talk about what to do with their hands and what to do with their heads, which have some relevance. But it's like this getting to the essence of the activity. What is giving you the bang for your buck? What's the most important thing that's going to allow you to run faster, to dodge, to have agility, whatever it will be? And it's coming back to what really matters, and where your little pinky finger is just coach trying to be clever.
Fair enough. And then you've also worked, so another world where I guess the mechanics and the movement stuff, so you've done a bit of stuff with ballet. So ballet, I've got a good friend who works in the Royal Ballet, so there'd be some
I was coaching at the college next door, and they wanted somebody on biomechanics and anatomy to, because these ballet girls about 17-18 needed to take an exam to be a teacher. So I did what I normally do, which is I don't know anything about ballet. If I'm going to teach these people, I've got to go find out about it. So I've got to go in and look at what they do and try and find something to get a hook in so that I can relate to the people. So I went across, I said, do you mind if I come into some lessons? And the ballet teacher said, with a kind of funny smile on his face, he said, yeah, come into the session. I said, but I've just got one question. One thing I want to ask you is that you don't say anything when you come in. And I thought, that's reasonable. I don't want to interfere in the session. I just want to observe. So I went into the session, and there's a lot of giggling and tittering from the girls, and a little bit, because it's a male in the room. I was about 25 at the time, and I'd just come in off the football field. I'd been coaching football, came in my shorts, and I sat at the back, and they went out, and they were looking across, and the ballet teacher came over to me, and he says, do you understand why they were chatting? I said, not a clue. He said, come with me. So he walked me down the corridor, opened up his office door, and I looked across, and I thought I was looking in the mirror. But it was actually a picture on the wall of Baryshnikov. And he said, now do you get the joke? And he set me up for this joke with, he told the students that this VIP Baryshnikov was coming to watch their session. And to be fair, at the time, I did, you know, the guy was in later in Sex and the City, people remember as the Russian that with Carrie Bradshaw. And about that time, he's about 12, 15 years older than me, but we did look very similar. And I've been asked for my autograph a number of times, particularly in the States, about it. So that got me started. But what I did do was I got from the session before I found out about that, this interesting stuff. It was they were doing, some people know, Grand Jetty en Tournant, and it's basically a jump which makes you look as if you've leapt really high into the air. And it the analogy would be Michael Jordan hanging in basketball. And the thing is, you look like you're defying physics, but what you're really doing, it's an illusion created by how you manipulate the arms and legs in order to appear to hang in the air. And I thought, I can explain this. So I went to other sessions with them, and they turned to me, the students said, is that possible? Because they'd be told to jump and stay there. And that was the coaching point. Jump and stay there. You know, it's like, so of course they weren't doing it very well because they weren't getting any information. So hence I was able to kind of explain it. Because one thing about biomechanics is normally what it does is explains what a coach or performer has achieved and allows you to understand why. So no biomechanician ever invented the Fosbury flop, but plenty of biomechanicians will explain to you why it's more efficient to do a Fosbury flop than some other technique. So that's how I got involved. And I ended up writing a paper on turnout in dance and about how injuries were happening in the way that dancers were trained and what the extreme positions were going into. And that was the start of my stuff in injury prevention and a passion for that, because I'd had a bad back since I was 17 and got involved in that. And what I like about the injury prevention is, as I came across, I don't know if you've come across the 11 plus, which is the football way of trying to reduce ACL and lower limb injuries. And they tried to pioneer this because there were so many problems, particularly with teenage girls. They pioneered this, but they found that the coaches actually doing it because they didn't buy into it. They didn't understand it. They didn't know why. So the injury rates didn't go down. As soon as they made it into a warm-up and the clubs were doing it on a regular basis, the injury rates dropped dramatically. So it was about the take-up. So if you want to, the parallel for me is, if there's something, whether it be cultural, that you want to introduce into your club, try and get it into the warm-up or the cool-down so that it's done on a regular basis, not a one-off session to explain why we should do X, but make it part of the regular training. And one way is to build it into a warm-up.
Yeah, so yeah, I'm definitely looking at 11 plus. Obviously, in rugby, we've got the concussion warm up.
And that's similar to the 11 plus football one for ACLs and ankle injuries.
Well, what else did you notice in the arts that you carried across? So you know, ballet, dance, stuff like that. Have you learned from their coaching?
The motor skill ability, is take something like rhythmic gymnastics, the fine-tuning, coordination, balance, what the human body can achieve sometimes shows up far more in the arts or in something like rhythmic gymnastics or even synchronized swimming. The qualities to actually do it, I mean, synchronized swimming with the nose pins and the big smile just doesn't do it for me. But the performance, the ability they have to move in the water is astonishing. That what rhythmic gymnastics can do with a ball beats the juggling that the average footballer does. So for me, it was opening my eyes to there's far more possible than probably we realize about what the human body is capable of.
My wife keeps telling me what my daughter's doing in rhythmic gym and synchronized swimming, and it is blowing my mind.
Yeah, being somebody who's a rubbish swimmer, I'm in awe of what they can do.
Yeah. And what have you taken from skiing to invasion, and what would you take from invasion to skiing? I'm definitely interested in some of the individual aspects as well.
I've spent more of my time, certainly at a higher level with individual sports, whether it be the swimming stuff, the athletics in my early career, and the skiing. And interestingly, it's not, I don't think since I really started doing more performance level in coaching in skiing and being supported there, I haven't really been involved in Eurasian sports. And so the opportunity to go back is, you know, you've asked me a question that's never actually occurred to me, what I could take from that other than what I get from every time I watch a session, every time I watch sport, I kind of get a little bit better as a coach myself. I get better observing, da da da. But there's no formalization for it at this point, and not an opportunity. You've asked me a question that I'm now going to ponder on for the next 2 or 3 days.
Well, next time you're back in England, you can definitely come and coach some rugby with me. That would be pretty exciting. Tell me about the starts. So I know you know it was only a small moment in time that you had. Yeah. However, I mean, it's clearly had significant impact, which is often the case. Tell me about it.
Well, I was obviously teaching sprint starts because I was with the track team. The swimming coach, they knew me. They knew the biomechanics. They knew I'd been supporting other coaches with a performance analysis look. And they turned to me and it really surprised me. They said, you know, this guy had coached world champions and world record holders. And he said, you know, none of us know how to teach starts. We just don't do it. Will you come in and have a go? The thing was, it was fairly transferable because people had moved to what they call a track start. So 1 foot forward, 1 foot back instead of a grab start. But the thing they had one swimmer there was very good, but had never converted from the grab start. And part of that was mental. And they brought me in to be a different face and approach it in a different way and explore what could be done. So really, instead of doing what a biomechanician would probably normally do, which is set the angles, measure the angles, set it up very technically, I let them explore what width of stance was going to do well. So we do that and that. The same with Joseph. Went down to the pool, I explained how I worked with it, and I said, what I'd actually expect you to do is experiment with this, and I can show you how we would set up the experiment, and you need to keep on doing it. Because he said, again, nobody had given him any work on starts. So I just said, I can't give you an ideal start right now, because you're going to grow, you're going to change, and by practice, things will change for you. But here's the process that I would go through. And I would do this. You can do this for yourself. And the great thing about becoming better at something is you need to vary that practice anyway, so that you come around the sweet spot and become better at it. So I gave him a process to follow that would enable him to evolve what was best for him.
Give me some clues as to some of the processes, some parts of the process.
Well, one of the key parts was establishing how wide apart to put his feet, how far back from the block to have the first foot, what angle to set the block at. Because if you take a lot of people will take the ball of the foot onto the block. You can also put the whole of the foot on the block, because what happens is your ankle does not go back because it's already supported by the block. So you tend to leave the block earlier, but not necessarily faster. And I asked him to try those different things and time them and measure them until he was sure and confident. And that was one of the things, that he was confident that the placement of his feet, the placement of the blocks, the angle of the blocks were optimal for him.
Yeah, which is something we probably don't do enough. I'm thinking again about probably passing and probably tackling in rugby. We often think that's the exact model for every single person, and we probably don't allow that to explore it enough. And you think like a coach, really.
Yeah, it's easier in a sport like athletics, and it's easier in a sport like swimming, because it's a closed skill on the block, apart from the pressure issue. Nobody's trying to stop you doing it. Nobody's trying to interfere with what you're doing. You know, it's not like England against New Zealand.
Yeah, wow. And so, and then he went on. So, I mean, and how's that been with you since then? So you had one day with him. He subsequently won Olympic gold.
Yeah.
What's been the? You're officially king of Singapore now, are you?
No. He's king of Singapore. I'm just pleased that I could play a tiny little part in the beginning of that story, and have an association with that, because I was never the only thing I was any good at with swimming teaching prior to that was teaching beginners, because I was such a bad swimmer that I could relate to those who were fearful of the water, didn't want to drown and thrash themselves around. So to go to the other end of the spectrum was really nice for me. And it's, to me, that's just, well, A, it's the width of experience and the length of experience that I've had, but that some of that science underpinning and being able to use that, for me, it's not about the science, it's whether it can do anything for you. Can, you know, as some people have said before, will it make the boat go faster?
Yeah, what do you wish you'd known when you were younger? What's the two or three things that... although remarkably sprightly now, a slightly older David would say to young okay. David, what's the
kind one, don't be afraid to fail. Two, you don't need to be in control of everything.
Nice.
And three, kind of in your wish to make people better, don't bully them.
Oh, wow.
Because I was guilty of all those things.
Yeah, I'm sure we all look back and definitely think we've learned some stuff along the way. Where I'm going to do some one-worders with you in a second. Where can people find
okay.
you? So you're, I love your website.
Probably best through the website, tinyurl.com/Dave Murray. Yeah. And there's plenty of free stuff on there, and there's links to there. I do have Twitter, but I don't use it that much, as you probably noticed.
Just to so put that would be the snowscapes on the
that's right.
else in the world.
Yeah, there was a time when I did a lot of posting of coach-related stuff, but it's not so common now.
I'll put a link out to your website, actually, because
I
did lots of cool stuff on there.
Okay.
And people can get hold of you through that. We always finish with a few one-worders. I've written some stuff down during the conversation.
Okay.
So one of them I'm definitely interested in. Skiing.
Landscape.
Rugby.
Sevens.
Oh, it's a much better version of the game. Well done, Dave. Actually, yeah. About to start today now. Japan.
Well, fantastic.
Loughborough.
Alma mater.
Coaching.
Sharing.
Nice, good answer. Teaching.
Passion.
Eddie the Eagle. Tell me about Eddie the Eagle.
Eddie the Eagle was a decent ski instructor who was desperate to get into the Olympic team. I think it was great. I'm appalled, really, that they changed the rules so that people like him were not able to take part in the Olympics in the future. Because to me, he didn't spoil it. He did the best he could in a British amateur tradition. And you should allow, for my money, the best in the country to go to the Olympics. I don't particularly subscribe to having minimum standards. One person should be allowed per event, in my view. And he did that. And I tell you what, I would not do a ski jump. It would scare the bejesus out of me. I've stood at the top of the one at Sapporo and thought, there's no way I could throw myself off here. No way.
He so, definitely brought a ski jump to life. And every time I drive past the ski slope that we trained at, it brings a smile to my face. So on that note, mate, it's been awesome. I'm excited for you to come back and coach some rugby with me.
I'd love to.
It's a return trip to Japan for ski coaching.
and you have to join me on the slopes one day.
Oh, mate, that's definitely a deal. That's a 100% deal. Yeah. Mate, look, enjoy the rest of your trip in Japan, and we'll catch up when you're back.
I will. Thank you. I'm privileged to be invited.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers. Bye.